You're listening to High Control, a podcast about identifying, leaving, and recovering from high control, high demand groups, also known as cults. We're not experts, but we do know what it's like to be a part of and then leave a cult. Your high control journey starts now.
Welcome to the High Control Podcast. My name is Scott Lloyd, along with my friend Allie Henney. High Control is a podcast designed for us to share our experiences with high control religious groups and other cults, and to encourage others to share their stories or perhaps provide information for those that want to escape high control groups or culty religions. Allie, how are you today?
I'm doing all right, Scott. I'm doing all right. How are you
doing? I'm doing good, and I'm honored to be with you once again. And today's episode is going to be very interesting because I know that you have written a great deal about race and race relationships and systemic racism in the United States. And today we're going to talk about a subject that pertains to me specifically, because we're talking about the fact that cults are for white people, or we're going to try to answer the question, are they for white people? And I would certainly speak from my experience. I saw a lot of white people in my culty United Pentecostal church growing up, very few black people. There were times where we made outreaches into the black community. And I put that outreaches in quotation marks because we never really intended to transform the look or the leadership or the style of our church. We just wanted to pay lip service, if you will, to the Great Commission, and felt like it was our responsibility. And this goes to a lot of intersections, the idea of white saviorism, the idea of gospel groups being convinced that they have the answer for black communities. And of course, this goes into the entire history, the problematic history of our nation around the issue of race. But I'll let you give some opening thoughts, and I have some thoughts of my own that I want to share as well. But I'll give you the first word on the question, are cults for white people?
So yeah, that's an interesting question. And I think that the answer to that is kind of complex. It's easy, but it's complex. Like, I'm going to speak in paradoxes here, I guess, do like cult, like word salad type stuff. It's easy, but it's complex, but it's also easy. But anyway, in the short answer is no. Cults aren't exclusively for white people. Like, there are black, like, cultic groups. There are black, like, abusive, you know, like, Christian churches. There are different sects of sort of some of the mainstream religions, like Islam, like Judaism, Christianity, and other things that have bred cults that have been led by black folks. But I think that, like, there's a couple of different things going on whenever we answer that question. So first of all, like, yes, there are black high control groups that exist. And then there's also black people who join high control groups that are often led by white people. So, like, we talk about, like, the Jehovah's Witnesses, like, that is almost universally derided, like, as a cult. Right now, I'm sure that there's probably going to be, like, some Jehovah's Witness people jump up in here and be like, no, we're not a cult, blah, 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 blah. But it's almost universally accepted that the Jehovah's Witnesses are a cult. Well, there are a lot of black Jehovah's Witnesses, and there are, like, famous black Jehovah's Witnesses, which I think is really interesting. So, like, Michael Jackson grew up a Jehovah's Witness, Prince grew up a Jehovah's Witness. There's a few more that I am not thinking of right now off the top of my head. There's somebody just recently that I was like, she grew up a Jehovah's Witness, and I don't think it was Taraji P. Henson. It was somebody that I was like, oh, I didn't realize that she grew up a Jehovah's Witness, but it was a woman, a famous black woman, and I'm not, like, thinking of who it is right now. But anyway, so, like, there's a Jehovah's Witness church, temple, whatever it's called, but a place of worship literally around the corner from my house on the south side of Chicago. Every Saturday, whenever my family, like, we go out to do things, I see Jehovah's Witnesses. I see Black Jehovah's Witnesses, you know, going door to door and doing things. So people who are Black people being part of high control groups and Black-led high control groups, those things do exist. But then there's also this very kind of interesting thing where we have what I would maybe call like the cult industrial complex, where you have like the cult documentaries, the cult podcasts, the cult books, all that other type of stuff. By and large, it's talking about cults that are primarily led by white people and primarily inhabited mm-hmm. by white people. Now, you get some kind of, I don't want to say exceptions, I don't want to call them exceptions, but something that also can happen in some of these is that people of color get erased. So like the Jonestown Massacre, like whenever people talk about cults, people talk about Jonestown. The People's Temple, now Jim Jones was a white man, but the primary folks that he was pulling into his little cult, right, were Black. They were Black people from, they were Black impoverished, disadvantaged people. And so a lot of those folks, they jumped on the idea, because I mean, you know, Black people, a lot of us are Christian and stuff anyway. So like a lot of our religious makeup is Christian, or you know, it can be Islam. Like there are a lot of Black folks who practice Islam, and not just Nation of Islam, but like practice some of the mainstream branches of Islam. Those are kind of the two biggest religious representations, I think, in African American identity. But you have like where you're capitalizing on people's like their desire for heaven, their desire for being free from oppression and all this other type of stuff. And Jim Jones exploited that. And the Black and the Black folks who died and the Black folks that he exploited to get to where he's at, they often get erased from the narrative. And I think that like within the cult industrial mm-hmm. complex, sometimes like you'll watch some of these documentaries, and sometimes, you know, you'll see, I can't remember, I think it was called like, it was called something else, but it was like the OSHA cult, I think is what the name of it was. There's a Netflix documentary called Wild Wild Country, that it was like actually like an Indian right. dude who did it. Like, I mean, whenever I say Indian, I don't mean like indigenous, I mean a dude yes. from India. I think his name was like Ranjish or something like that. They called him like I can't remember. It's like, I want to say like the Bhagavad, but that's not it. I'm thinking Bhagavad Gita, but it's very close to that. But anyway, so you have like, so you have some of those instances where like you have this Indian dude leading a cult, but then most of the people who were there mm-hmm. were white. And so most of the people there were like white people from like LA. It's really interesting. I mean, like I think of like right. NXIVM, most of them folks mm-hmm. was white. And then like, I think in like the second season, they did like talk to a Black person who was like still in. And like occasionally, like, you know, you would see, like you look at just all these different cults where there's documentaries, like you occasionally will see like, you know, one or two Black folks. I was, you know, one of, you know, a handful of Black folks in some of the things that I was in. But anyway, that's, you know, that's probably more bang for your buck than what you want. But so I guess to kind of, you know, bring it back to a thing, no, cults aren't for white people. Cults, white, Black people, brown people, indigenous people, like we do join cults. But I maybe just kind of want to be like, yeah, you know, cults are some white people, like that's some white people's stuff. Cause like the stuff that you see is like,
Yeah. And I think we talked about this on an earlier episode, but in my estimation, I do believe, at least, you know, from just observation, it seems as if white people generally are attracted to high control religious groups or cult like groups or just straight up cults. And I think the reason why, and again, this is just an observation, I don't have any data to back this up. I think that Black people of color, because of the oppression, the historic oppression and systemic oppression that continues in the United States and in other parts of the world, They have a built-in community where they thrive with one another, whereas us white folks, we sometimes see ourselves as disconnected individuals longing for a place to belong, longing for community. And so when someone comes along with some sort of a religious innovation or new idea or enlightenment, we immediately, white people, gravitate towards those kinds of leaders and those kinds of groups because we don't see ourselves generally as belonging to a collective, but rather we view ourselves as individuals. And that has all kinds of issues in and of itself. And I think historically speaking, if we look specifically at the United Pentecostal Church, at what I grew up in, at other forms of Pentecostalism, you know, Jim Jones of Jonestown had this sort of style, a stylistic Pentecostal flair to his particular ministry. What you see in a lot of those groups is appropriation of Black worship styles or Black innovations of leadership. I think of Pentecostalism, and we go back to Azusa Street, 1906 in Los Angeles, and William J. Seymour, who was the son of former slaves from Louisiana. And of course, he was a student of Charles Parham, who was white, who first introduced this famously, and in a big way, introduced this idea of speaking with other tongues as the initial evidence of receiving the Holy Spirit. It was in other places, but his innovation was he connected the two in a big way and made it popular. And Seymour was a student of Parham's and invited him to Azusa Street, where when Parham showed up, Seymour was doing exactly what he was had been taught about speaking in tongues. But Parham, on seeing Black people and white people worship together, specifically in the altar area, seeing Black people and white people, Black men and white women praying together, he dismissed that revival in the crudest, racist terms. And thankfully, the good people of Azusa Street locked him out of the church, and Seymour did as well, and turned Parham away. But what happened in those 3 years at Azusa Street, you had a lot of pastors from the South, white pastors, come and experience the leadership, the profound leadership of Seymour, and what was happening at Azusa Street, appropriate what they wanted, take it back to the South, and then exclude Black people from that experience. And so what you ended up with in Pentecostalism was a lot of mediocre imitation. And that's exactly what we have today. You have white people who appropriated Black innovations and Black worship styles of Christianity, and they're attempting to reproduce it in a mediocre way that is dismissive to Black people. Even Seymour, later on in his life, he was never recognized for the contributions that he made and basically died in obscurity. He would attend large conferences of Pentecostal gatherings, and he would not even be recognized by the white pastors that were leading those particular groups. So I think there's a lot of that in play as well that needs to be addressed.
Yeah, you know, you talk about Seymour. He was effectively erased from Pentecostal history for almost 100 years. Like literally, that's not an exaggeration. Literally, for like 100 years, he was completely erased, and it was always Charles Parham that they would bet that people would promote, or they would promote Charles Parham next to William Seymour. Whenever he didn't do anything, like. Charles Fox Parham didn't do crap, but white people always want to try to like throw his white Pentecostals will always try to throw his name in it. And I remember whenever I was in seminary, I read this book called Black Fire, by Australia Y. Alexander, and that is an excellent book. And let me tell you, There were multiple times that I literally like threw the book across the room, like reading about it. Cause I read it from, it's a very mm-hmm. thick book. But I read it from cover to cover, as research for a class that I was taking. And there were so many times that I just like shouted out and like was like yelling and like literally physically like threw the book across the room because I was angry. It's still in really good condition. I'm surprised. So my book is still
it's testimony to the thickness of the book.
That's a testimony to the thickness of how big that book is, because yeah, I definitely yoked it several times. It was definitely like yeet, just like threw it because I was so angry at some of the stuff. At some of the stuff that she was revealing in some of the racism, some of the racist stuff. So there's definitely like this erasure and you know, different denominations that have sprung up from that have, some of them have had the temerity, and I say the temerity and not, I'm not congratulating them in any way, because they had the temerity to try mm-hmm. to apologize for what they did, yet they still continue to be racist. But you know, hey, we're gonna apologize. You know, we're gonna do all this, you know, racial reconciliation, quote unquote stuff, which I think is, which is in some ways is very insulting to me. In seeing how some of these pastors, some of these people within some of these denominations, still view and still treat their fellow Black Christians. But that's besides the point. But something that you said toward the beginning that I want to come back to is about like the sense of community that that a lot of communities of color will have. And that's something that I didn't point out in my initial comments, but that I think is something that's important to say, that a lot of the cults in Black culture, at least that to where I've experienced it, if not firsthand experience, having friends, having loved ones who maybe would get involved with or become like kind of tangential to some of these things. Some of these things are folded into the Black community, right? And so, like, I'm not going to call any names of any groups, because I'm not really I don't know who's going to listen to this. I'm not really trying to have anybody get mad at me for what I'm calling cults or not. But those of us who know, we know about some of these certain groups that we probably have cousins, we probably, you know, have relatives or have friends, have neighbors who have been part of these groups at some point. Or who maybe have passed through some of these groups, or who maybe look kind of to some of these groups, even if they haven't formally joined them, they kind of look to them for ideas. They kind of see them as thought leaders or whatever. But because our communities tend to not be, we tend to not be isolated. Now, we might be isolated like in terms of segregation. So like I think of, you know, myself growing up in a small rural town in Missouri, I felt isolated in some ways from Black culture and from other Black people, even though we had a Black community, but that felt isolated in some ways. So you can experience isolation in that respect. But in terms of like the Black community itself, rarely do you have where Black folks are just isolated completely from one another. And so that can happen, but that's very rare. And so whenever you have these religious groups or these other types of high control groups pop up in Black circles, it doesn't necessarily require a person to leave the Black community, to leave their community in order to still be part of these groups. Now, that there's exceptions to that. Like some people might get real heavy involved with somebody. Like there's always exceptions to that. But you might have a cousin who's part of XYZ religion, and they still come to the family thing, and they might still be on their thing, and they might, you know, not be eating certain foods, or might be, you know, be preaching or doing certain things, but I have not often seen where it's like, oh, somebody is completely in terms of like a black led cult where you're completely cut off from your family. And even for myself and being part of some of these religious groups that were high control, I never felt isolated from my family. My family was still, I mean, as much as they were as much as part of my life then as they were now. So there wasn't this separation. But I say all of that then to say that I think that the reason why Black cults don't pop on the cult radar as much is because they're sort of folded into the community, and people kind of even can be transient and kind of move in and out of some of these groups. And so it's kind of like, oh great, you know, so-and-so's over, like I'm glad that cousin so-and-so is over their, you know, whatever religion phase. And like, yes, there are people absolutely that get pulled in very deep, and it can be tragic and hard for families for losing that family member. But our sense of community, our sense of oneness kind of as a community, I think you don't see that. And then I would also add to that some of the destructive elements you don't see quite as much or quite right. as often or in the same way. So like you're not, so like, and maybe it's just that it's not popping up on the news or whatever, but like you're not necessarily seeing like the mass suicides, and you're not seeing like the, we're gonna be in a compound and we're gonna live together. You don't necessarily see some of the stockpiling weapons and that sort of stuff. And that's not to say, because there are groups in history who have done, Black groups in history who have done some of these things. But I would say that in general, the white cult experience versus the Black cult experience is completely different. And the last thing I'll say about this is I think it just even compare and contrast like the UPC and the PAW. Now, I might be getting too much dip on my chip here, but my experience of the PAW was like, I'm not saying that there weren't controlling groups in the Pentecostal Assemblies of the World, which was the Black that Oneness Pentecostal organization that actually predates the UPC by like 40 years or 20 or 30 years or something like that. And some of the pastors who went on to do the UPC, create the UPC, actually came out of the PAW, but that's a whole other different story. But like, I think that, you know, there just wasn't that level. I never saw the same level of control, the same, we've got to be uniform in everything. So like the church that I grew up in, we fellowshipped with a couple of the other PAW churches in the area. But then we would all get together with like Black Methodist churches and Black Baptist churches, and we would try, and maybe it was just a quirk of the church that I grew up in, but we would have people because it was the Blackness that united us and not necessarily the doctrine. Now in the UPC, it was unheard of to be like, it was, they would be questioning you if you had a youth rally and invited the Baptist youth group and the Assemblies of God youth group and the Church of the Nazarene youth group, and y'all are just there, and you're not sitting here trying to preach oneness to them. You're not sitting here trying to get them baptized in Jesus' name and filled with the Holy Ghost. Like, and you were just there worshiping, and they preached in your church, or somebody saying that would have been unheard of. You would have gotten kicked out for that. Yeah. UPC.
And you know, it's so interesting how different groups function. If you see them identifying or predominantly Black versus predominantly white groups. And when we examine these predominantly white groups, whether they're cultish or otherwise in the United States, I think we have to acknowledge that at the base of so much of these group identities, and when I'm talking about white people, is this assumption of white supremacy. And what I mean by that is when these groups get together, a lot of times you hear rhetoric, it's either overt or subvert, the idea that somehow we are God's chosen people, we're an extension of that, or we are exceptional, or we are unique, we have a unique revelation, we have a unique truth, and it is our responsibility collectively as white people to take this truth, this exclusive truth, to all the nations of the world. I remember sitting on the pew in a Pentecostal church many nights and having missionaries come through, and they would show these pictures, right, of other people, mostly Black and brown people in other countries. And they, you know, they would attempt to shock the audience by throwing around terms like witchcraft and devil worship and animal sacrifice and pagan. And the the intended or unintended message was, us white people are better. We are civilized. We are pure. We have the unadulterated gospel to take to all of these people because we know better. And, you know, that was part of the United States formation. When people came to this nation, they were convinced, a lot of them, that they knew better. My goodness, go back to the Document of Discoveries that Christopher Columbus and his gang were reading to folks, you know, you convert or die. And if we rape and kill and plunder and take everything from you, it will be your fault because God is on our side. So you either convert to Christianity right now, surrender all of your rights, all your land, all your wealth, or we will kill you and it will be on your hands. These were actual words and ideas that were communicated by European people and later collectively as that identity coalesced around the color white, this idea that we have this manifest destiny. And if our listeners have ever seen that depiction, that mural, that picture of the manifest destiny, in the middle of it, there's this white angelic female representation of a angelic being carrying the light. And behind her, you see all of the settlers moving west, all of the white folks. And in front of her, you see the darkness fleeing. As all of the brown and black and indigenous people flee before her. And that was the idea that we embrace. That was the idea that many white people in this country still embrace. And so I say that a lot of white cults get together because for whatever reason, they feel like their power, their privilege, their status, because they see the world is changing, they see changing demographics, and they see changes in the law that are making things equal. And because they've lived so many years of their life in feeling like they were superior, they interpret equality as superiority. And they think that is what is happening in our nation. And they actually get together and they subvert the ideas of civil rights, the ideas of justice and equality, and they attempt to appropriate that as if those white groups are now the ones that are being discriminated against, that they're now the ones that are being erased and replaced, that they're now the ones that are experiencing injustice. And it only speaks to the fears that a lot of these white groups have because they understand the inequality that has been perpetuated by white people in this nation and around the world for so long. And they interpret what is happening as the horror and the harm that they have perpetuated is coming back on them now.
Yeah, you know, it's wild because I think that one of the hallmarks of cults is actually us versus mm-hmm. them thinking. And so, you know, some of the stuff that you're saying could very easily apply to mainstream white evangelical Christianity, mm-hmm. which, you know, maybe raises the question, is that a cult?
Exactly.
I will say, not having identified as, definitely not as white evangelical, but not having identified as an evangelical myself, but having been adjacent to that culture as a Pentecostal. So like Pentecostals forever, and you might remember this in your lifetime also, Scott, that like, not saying, not calling you old, but just saying that you
got a few years.
You are seasoned and you are seasoned.
Let's just tell the truth. I'm old.
Well, you know, my sister is a couple years younger than you. We have an age gap and everything. So I don't view you maybe quite as old. But within Pentecostalism, Pentecostals used to look at themselves as separate and distinct from the rest of Christianity. So whether that's mainline Protestant denominations, mm-hmm. whether that's Catholicism, or whether that is evangelicalism. Now it gets a little bit Harry there because, like, the Assemblies of God, which is the largest Pentecostal denomination in the U.S., was actually a founding member of the NEA, of the National Evangelical Association, that was founded by Billy Graham back in, like, 1946, I think it was. So it's really interesting that they joined this this coalition, essentially. But identity-wise, what they preached all that time up to, like, probably I would say up until, like, the election of Barack Obama, I think that was the tipping point where I have a theory. I don't have data to back this up, but I have a very strong working theory that that there are two forces that sort of helped fold Pentecostalism into evangelicalism. The first force actually had to do with the contemporary worship music. So, like, Hillsong, whose music has been played for the last 30 years throughout Christianity. They are the Australian Assemblies of God. They're part of the Assemblies of God. They're in the Australian branch of the Assemblies of God. Again, you know, one of the largest Pentecostal denominations in the world, the largest in the United States, and one of the largest. I don't know if they are actually the largest in the world. I think that might be another movement that is the largest in the world. But anyway, Hillsong, the contemporary worship music, Christian radio, all of that sort of stuff brought about a Pentecostalization of evangelicalism. And there's actually have been some articles and stuff written about this. I think Christianity Today maybe did something about it. Maybe Charisma might have talked about it, but I feel like I remember there being a Christianity Today article. But don't quote me on that. But how evangelical churches have become more Pentecostal. Like, you know, back in the 90s, you wouldn't, you know, go to a white Baptist church and see people, you know, lifting their hands and that type of stuff. That was a very Pentecostal expression of worship. Now you can go into a lot of Baptist churches in America and as a lot of Southern Baptist churches in America and see that physical expression. There you go, Pentecostalization. Right. So there was that, but then there was also, there was that force that was working to start, and that started happening in, like, the late 90s and early 2000s. I used to live in Springfield, Missouri, where the Assemblies of God is headquartered, which is why I probably know a lot about the Assemblies of God. But I remember some friends of mine who went to one of their universities talking about how one of the pastors from the the big Southern Baptist church in town had come to preach Evangel's chapel. And they had said, even then, you know, back in 2004, 2005-ish, like, this never would have happened years ago. Like, this wouldn't have happened, but, you know, here I am. And, you know, back in Springfield, people would go back and forth, you know, between Assemblies of God and Southern Baptist churches because they couldn't tell the difference. That was a joke, is that they couldn't tell the difference. And it was kind of shade being thrown at both denominations. But I won't get into that. But you have that force. And then you also had the election of Barack Obama, where you have a Black man becoming president. And so you have, like, this need for further political consolidation among white Christians, among white Protestant, and there's even a coalition between Catholics and Protestants, mostly over the issue of abortion. That's where you see some of the overlap. So you even see, like, Catholicism sort of coming into Pentecostal circles, Catholic or Pentecostal and charismatic circles, where, you know, Catholic ideas about birth control and about all these other types of things that people weren't against, you know, 20, 30, 40 years ago, because there's been the symbiotic relationship between those movements. Now you see some of those ideas coming in, bleeding into Pentecostalism, bleeding into the charismatic movement. So all that's to say that now here we are. We had Barack Obama elected in 2008, reelected elected twice, and then in 2016. The white lash, the white backlash to Barack Obama, we have Donald Trump become president. So now we have this consolidation now around this identity, this idea of making America great again, whatever that is supposed to mean. But we have this consolidation of this idea and these people, and a lot of it is based in racism. And a lot of it, whenever you get down to whenever you get down to like the nitty gritty of it, the fears, the things, the ideas that they promote, the ideal America that they try to promote, it's all racism. And so it's very interesting then, because you mentioned, you know, that this is happening in some of these high control religious groups, and it's that us versus them. But this is so that thinking has become so mainstream. There is an us versus them in what a lot of us would term mainstream Protestant Christianity. Yet, so I think that definitely raises the question, well, you know, Southern Baptist Convention, the Global Methodist Church, the group that just split off from the United Methodist Church, the Assemblies of God, the Church of God, other denominations. It sort of raises the questions, you know, question like, I don't know if they fit the whole, all of the checkpoints of what would be a cult, but it definitely, that us versus them thing definitely raises some red flags.
And it raises the question as to whether or not white supremacy and systemic racism that has always been a part of the fabric of the United States since its founding and before, and globally in other parts of the world, whether or not white supremacy is the biggest cult of all. And we'll talk more about that on the other side of a short break. You're listening to High Control. My name is Scott Lloyd, along with Allie Henney. We'll continue in just a moment. To the High Control Podcast. I'm Scott Lloyd, along with my friend Allie Henney, and today we are addressing the question, are cults for white people? And before the break, Allie, we were exploring this idea how in so many of these groups, they're centered around the us versus them thinking. And I know that when I've taught group dynamics, and when we look at how groups form and the cohesion that keeps groups together, which is necessary for us to survive as a species, for humanity to progress. But what happens with a lot of these groups, they coalesce around an idea that creates strength and creates an imbalance. And it's based around the idea of us versus them. And in group dynamics, there are terms that we use. One of them is publics, and then counterpublics. And so what a public is defined as is the larger culture. It's the dominant group within society. And for so long in the United States, because it was perpetuated by the rule of law and by founding documents and by the institutions of slavery and violence that have been throughout our history as a nation, the white community, or those that identified as white, appeared as white, coalesced around this idea of superiority, so that in the United States, everything was viewed through the lens of whiteness. So even immigrants that would have come to this nation from other parts of the world, bringing their culture, they were forced to assimilate. And in the United States, it wasn't that long after our founding. In fact, these ideas were developing before our founding and informed the slave trade, was the idea that there are two groups of people in the world. There are white people and there are black people. And for centuries, this ideology that white people were superior to black people informed all of these atrocities that were being committed in the name of religion, in the name of economics, but it was all designed to prop up this idea of white supremacy. So you had that white dominant culture known as a public, and then you had counterpublics that formed, black people, brown people, marginalized people. And we see this continuing in our nation today and in our world today with LGBTQ, trans people, et cetera, forming counterpublics that form communities to push back against the dominance of the publics. But now we have this phenomenon that some scholars are referring to as parasitic publics. And what they mean by parasitic publics, if you think of a parasite, is something that attaches itself to a host and feeds off of it, but then robs it of its power. So you have a lot of white groups, and I would certainly put MAGA, the MAGA group and the MAGA movement with Donald Trump in this category. They are forming what they refer to themselves as counterpublics because they believe that they're being robbed of power and status and privilege. And when in reality, what they are parasitic publics that are masquerading as counterpublics because they're not facing any real oppression. They're not facing any real harm. What they're seeing is a movement of society to become more equal. And because they're being robbed of their power, they see it as others rising in superiority. And so you'll have them appropriating a lot of the language of civil rights movements, and they'll talk about oppression and injustice, when in fact they're just feeding off of historical movements throughout history and confusing especially a lot of white people and actually radicalizing them to a point of violence, to a point of fear. And unfortunately, we see that in a lot of these church groups that coalesce around this idea that we are better and everyone else needs to hear the gospel. I know I referenced this in the opening, but growing up in my small Pentecostal church, we were a part of a community in Northeast Arkansas that was 60% demographically black, and we were a predominantly white church. Yet in our small rural town, even though we had those demographics, we had a white mayor, we had a white city council. All of the power structures in that Delta town were controlled by white people. Black people even were living in a different part of the city. And if they attempted to move in to white neighborhoods, there was backlash. And so growing up, I remember a lot of language about we have a responsibility to reach out to the black community. And there were lots of fears that were associated around those particular communities. And everything that was bad in our community was because of the poverty and the crime of those black communities. And so it just speaks of the blatant racism that we accepted as the normal way of living. And it created an us versus them, but it was flipped and it was masquerading as some sort of gospel compassion and fulfilling the Great Commission. But in reality, it was just blatant racism attempting to masquerade as some sort of ill-fated compassion.
Yeah, you know, I think that the idea about parasitic publics that you mentioned, and how that even kind of goes with this idea of white people all of a sudden, you know, they're so oppressed, they're so whatever, you know, and so you frame that in terms of your spiritual community growing up, where it was like, oh, all these bad things are happening in our community. And the tacit thing there is it's because of the black people. That's like the quiet part, right, that nobody was saying, right, out loud, or maybe they were kind of saying it out loud. But the tacit, yes, thing was all these things are, all these community ills are happening because, mm-hmm, of the black people. And so we need to take the gospel to the, right, black people so that way those things, mm-hmm, will stop. Not because, you know, because we want to see people, you know, go to heaven and we want whatever. It's so it benefits us. So controlling these people's behavior benefits us. Aside from, I mean, there's a lot of other kind of racist, imperialist, colonialist things that I'm skipping over, to get to the point that this idea of the parasitic public, MAGA, is an example of a parasitic public. That, and I'll even go take it back, you know, 20 years, the Tea Party, that's where that started. That was a parasitic public in the Republican Party. Now, I mean, I really, the Republican Party can kiss my black behind. I really don't like Ronald Reagan, like, honestly, you know, I don't know if I believe in hell fully, this the way that a lot of people believe in hell. But I do believe that there's a bad place. And I believe that Ronald Reagan is in that bad place. And for me, hell, that's the bad place. Ronald Reagan is there. He is sown that man. Sorry, you know, to any of his loved ones who are listening, but that man has sown way too much dysfunction in this world that we can trace back in the last 40 years to that man. It's just hard for me to believe it's just hard for me to believe that he's not in somebody's hell somewhere, rotten in somebody's hell somewhere. And I really hope that he is. But anyway, the Republican Party don't really care for them. And I'm not a Democrat either, but I really don't care for the Republican Party. I have a different set of smoke for Joe Biden and the Democrats, but that's besides the point. But you had the GOP that was already standing for all this racism and all this other type of stuff. And yes, I know the party's flipped and it was the Democrats and it was whatever. So people, because I know, you know how people be like, well, it was the Democrats who were enslaving people. It's like, okay, but come on, like, open, like, read a history book. Just, yes, you know, please. I don't know, read Twitter or something. But anyway, so hopefully people don't get offended by me saying that, but that's just, them's my feelings. But anyway, you have this parasitic public of MAGA, of the Tea Party, that you have this already right-leaning group. You have this group that was already conservative, that was already about kind of holding a certain line of what they thought the society should be, and this ideal of this ideal society that they were trying to create. So you already have that. But then you have, in the 2000s, these people coming in and saying, well, even, like, we have a Republican president and he's not doing enough. Like, he's not quite doing enough. And so you have that toward the end of the Bush era, and then especially coalescing after Obama was elected, that was like, well, we need to be more conservative. We need to be more conservative in different ways. We got to protect marriage. We got to do this. We got to do that. We got to whatever. We got to, you know, marriage, abortion, whatever, fiscal, whatever it was. And so that was already this parasite that then developed over the Obama years into what now has become MAGA. And so that has become a parasitic public within the Republican Party. Well, you take those ideas and you can say, people, there's a whole book that Stephen Hassan wrote called the Cult of Trump. I haven't read it. I have not read it, so I can't, you know, attest to, you know, how good, bad, ugly, indifferent it is. But there's somebody, but Stephen Hassan is a renowned cult expert, and he has named the whole MAGA crowd, he has named that as a cult, as have other people have seen where there are definitely some cultic, that's where it's a political cult, because there's different types of cults, but where it has kind of come off as a political cult. But that same thing, that same parasitic public has also latched on to a lot of white evangelical mm-hmm. churches. And it's very interesting, again, because I have been doing some research and stuff on the International House of Prayer in Kansas City, because they're in the middle of a sex scandal right now. I feel like I mentioned that every episode. There's a lot more to it going on. I encourage you to Google it and to read about what's going on, because it's wild. But anyway, I was doing some research on them and was looking at archival newspaper articles about some of the leaders and some of the people who were kind of adjacent to that movement. And I happened to run across an article that it had interviewed a Christian pastor there in Kansas City, and it was actually talking about politics. And I'm not even going to try to quote what this pastor had said, but the whole idea of it was, like, you know, we're not really trying to get involved in politics. Now, mind you, this is a conservative, like, Pentecostal or a charismatic church that this pastor, because I was familiar with who the pastor was that was saying this, that it was basically like, yeah, his whole frame was basically like, yeah, you know, we're not really trying to get involved in all of this. Like, and he said, there was a bunch of other stuff that he said that was like, and I remember just thinking, wow, this is so counter to how the charismatic movement moves today. So this is a guy that's pastoring a church in a city that there are a lot of charismatic, there were at the time a lot of charismatics in Kansas City. So there were one of the churches, actually one of Mike Bickle's churches, was one of the fastest growing churches in America. Metro Vineyard, or it might be Metro Fellowship at the time, I can't remember, but was one of the fastest growing churches at the time. Was one of them was a charismatic church. I think a couple of them were Pentecostals. I think Phoenix First Assembly might have been on there too. But you have like, where this group of people that now, you know, 30 years later, is very political, is very much involved in the MAGA scene, in the political scene, you have at least one leader, at least one pastor saying, like, you know, yeah, like, you know, there are things that we care about, that we have certain values, but like, we're actually just kind of trying to stay out of some of this or whatever. And so I say all that to say that parasite of, it's not just MAGA, but it's, you know, conservative ideology, as a whole, that has taken over and hijacked a lot of churches that otherwise would maybe have people from across the political spectrum, might lean a little bit more right. But I mean, I remember, you know, worshiping in churches where I don't want to say politics didn't matter, because politics do matter, but where being a Democrat, so me growing up a Democrat wasn't like growing up in a family that was Democrat, that voted Democrat. That wasn't, I no longer identify myself as a Democrat. But like, I was a Democrat, and like, that wasn't, right. that wasn't seen in the early 2000s. I wasn't, you know, jumping up and being like, I'm a Democrat, y'all, either, but it wasn't, but like, it wasn't, I just remember being in places where like, it just didn't quite matter. I also remember being in places where it was very, I remember in some of those same places also feeling like, oh, these people think that God's a Republican. That's weird. But like it was very clear that people thought that God was a Republican. Like, it was very clear, but like, I didn't feel like, oh, you're going to like kick me out of here for being a Democrat. But then at the same time, it was like, it's very different. It was a very different tone and tenor than it was in the post Obama, or like during the Obama era. I personally just saw a shift in the spaces that I was in, what I perceived as a shift in the rhetoric, as a shift. And if it wasn't being said in the pulpit, the way that people behaved. And so you would see, so you kind of have this thing kind of within some of these groups. And then the last thing that I'll say about that, about parasitic publics and even how they kind of work within more mainstream thing, the bringing it back to kind of like the culty angle a little bit. I'm not even gonna get the what the acronym stands for right, but the IBLP, Bill Gothard's right. group, with the whole the Quiverful mm-hmm. movement, yeah. Duggars, their whole joint that they had over there with that. So that they probably have churches now, and they probably have some churches that, you know, definitely or had some churches. I don't even know if they still exist. I'm guessing they still exist. I don't know. But there definitely are congregations that adhere to that doctrine, that adhere to some of those ideas. But in reality, at least whenever some of it was first starting out, it was people primarily in Baptist right. churches who they, Bill Gothard was teaching his stuff, right? You know, so he teaching the quiverful stuff. He teaching all this other type of stuff. They, you know, people be like, oh, hey, I'm going to go to this mm-hmm. seminar. And they go to the seminar and they get indoctrinated at the seminar. And then they try to bring that into right. their church. And some churches get infiltrated with it. And some churches, you know, split and stuff over it. But you see that even working within some of these groups. And so then to kind of answer the broader question that we've been asking in this segment is about evangelicalism and stuff. You know, is it a cult? I won't necessarily say that evangelicalism in and of itself is a cult, because I think that there are people who practice evangelical Christianity that they do so in a way that is not culty. I'm trying to choose my words very, very careful here, that very carefully here, that their churches, the way that they interact with that, it isn't destructive in the same way that you can see that become. But I would say that by my estimation, and I'm not like an evangelical church watcher, like at this point, like whenever yeah. I was out, like I'm done. Like I've not been connected really. I mean, I was never really connected in with it. And I talked about the Pentecostalization and all that other type of stuff, but I definitely was like not even adjacent to mainstream evangelicalism. Like it's been 12 years. It's because it's 2024. So it's been longer than that. It's been almost 15 years. I'm like, it's actually, it's closer to 15 years, but it's closer. It's more than a decade at this point. So so I say all of this, and I may be speaking from a place of ignorance, but from what I mm-hmm. have seen of what I would term mainstream evangelicalism, I would say that there is a parasitic public working within evangelicalism, and I'll say this, multiple parasitic Absolutely. Publics, multiple. So it's not just MAGA, but I mentioned, you know, like the IBLP. I mentioned like even like, you know, you could throw the International House of Prayer in there, or like, you know, certain other ministries, Bethel, and throw them out there. Different ones, Hillsong, and throw them out there. People can get mad that I call both of those a cult, but. We can fight about it because it's true, because I'm not lying. Them's cults. But anyway, so you have some of these parasitic publics, like multiple parasitic publics working within the system itself, and they kind of have glommed on to this thing that itself is probably a parasitic public. If we talk about the political angle of it, it probably is. But I think that. I would like to think, and I'm probably being idealistic, you probably correct me here, Scott, if I'm wrong, but I would like to think that just kind of general, like Billy Graham evangelical, like that's what I think of whenever I think of him, because he helped found the NEA. Whenever I think of the evangelical church, I think of like, you know, Billy Graham evangelicals, people that love Jesus, and they want people to know about Jesus, and they practice their faith, and that's it. I don't think that is a cult, but I think that within that there are subsets of people, and there are multiple parasitic publics. There's multiple bad faith actors at work within that system that have created cults within that system. And so it's not necessary. So yeah, there's more that I could say about that, but that's sort of kind of where I kind of land with it is that, and I don't know if anybody is really practicing Billy Graham evangelicalism right. anymore. If I'm real, like I'm trying to, you know, think of like who now are the Billy Graham evangelicals, and I can't find them, but I would like to think that they exist, but that could be wrong. I don't know.
You're exactly right. When you think about this in terms of, are there people in the United States that just, you know, they love Jesus, they love other people, and they're just going along to get along, but you have to think in terms as well and of the larger context of the history of the United States. And I think there's some great resources on this. And so I would recommend to people that they read the book Jesus and John Wayne. I forget the author's name, but perhaps we can put the book in the show notes.
I think it's Kristen Dume.
That's exactly right. And what she does wonderfully in that book is that she traces that thread throughout the modern era, and even includes Billy Graham in that group about how white people coalesced around these ideas of white supremacy, patriarchy, that perpetuated these systems of harm. And so if you think of it in those terms, again, back to the question before the break, the idea that white supremacy may indeed be the largest cult of all that continues to perpetuate itself throughout the United States. There's another book that I just finished called The Evangelical Imagination by Karen Swallow Pryor. And she is an English professor. And what she does, she traces evangelicalism through the past 300 years. And because she is a literary person, she looks at a lot of the books that are lifted up as the classics of Western civilization, and shows how they perpetuated harmful ideas into what we consider to be normative practices here in the United States. And I highly recommend Karen Swallow Pryor. She just recently left the Southern Baptist Convention. She taught at their seminary. Great author. And for all of our listeners, if you want to know more about white supremacy and how it impacts the church, you need to read Allie Henney's book, I Won't Shut Up. That is a great, great resource where she talks about and where you write about a lot of these particular issues as it impacted you personally. And so as we wind up, we like to talk about the things that grind our gears, right? So one of the things that continues to grind my gears as we address this issue of cults being for white people is that a lot of times you see the pastoral couple or family held up as the ideal of what everyone should be. And in a lot of these cults, I forget who pointed this out, it's not original with me, but you can find it, the idea that you usually have a white man who is the leader, but as his lieutenant, there's usually a skinny white woman. And I'm not attempting to body shame or stereotype there, but it's just a fact. If you look at a lot of these groups, there's a white man, and then as the lieutenant, there is a skinny white woman who is like rallying the troops, who is always there to quote unquote stand by her man, and is lifted up as the ideal of what everyone in the church should look like. And as we talked about in a former episode, interest is given to thinking about people that don't necessarily conform to whatever that skinny white woman looks like. And so this is a perpetuation of white supremacy in a different form that is upholding, look at our family, it's perfect, it's ideal, it's white, and this is what everyone should be. And if the man ever dares to preach anything that comes across as quote unquote woke, or if he does attempt to address what Jesus actually said, Russell Moore points this out, who is the president of Christianity Today, and he left the Southern Baptist Convention as well. In an interview with NPR, he talks about the fact that he was hearing from a lot of pastors that would preach the Sermon on the Mount, and their constituents would come up and say, you know, where are you getting all this woke liberal material? And he's like, well, these are the words of Jesus. And they would respond, well, that's weak. So that certainly grinds my gears when you have people attempting to say things against the actual words of Jesus and dismiss them because they don't align with their ideas of power and the fact that a lot of this rhetoric, a lot of these examples are coming from white men and their lieutenants embodied by skinny white women who are holding themselves up as the ideal. So what grinds your gears, Allie?
So yeah, so first of all, I'm pretty sure that it's Daniela Vincent.
Yes, absolutely. Young, thank you.
Who was the person who was talking about the skinny yes. white woman lieutenant yes. in cults. Like the lieutenant doesn't necessarily even have to be the wife. It can be just another skinny white woman within the infrastructure.
And her book is Uncultured. And we can put that in the show notes as well. Great book.
Oh yeah, yeah. That's a great book. I just finished listening to it a couple weeks ago. So the thing that grinds my gears, it's maybe a little bit more specific. It's a little bit more shop talk, sort of. But I remember because you had mentioned earlier that like your UPC church, like they wanted to reach out to like black people and whatever. Well, I remember in the UPC there was a department. Of African American yep. evangelism or black evangelism. I can't remember what, I think there was a department of African American evangelism.
Well, and I think it was called black evangelism or outreach to black people.
I can't remember like if it was officially black, and maybe some people were like, I don't want to say black, so I'm going to say African American. I don't remember, but I just remember it was something that existed. I never got involved with it. I think that there was a black guy because who was like one of the black guys that they would always chuck out.
There was always
stuff.
One.
They had a yeah. handful of them, like for real. And it was just like, hey, we're going to truck you out at different times. I think that it might have actually been headed by a black person, but I would not be surprised if it was a white man who was the head of it. But I remember it existing. And at first I was like, okay. Cause I mean, I grew up, with a strong, like, black American cultural identity and stuff. So anything that like, ostensibly seemed to cater to black people, I would always think like, oh, that's positive that exists. So at first I was like, oh yeah, that's positive that exists. I mean, at least like you realize that this denomination is very white and is full of white people and you want to try to change that. And I was really interested in changing that because I was tired of being one of like, I was like the only black adult for a lot of the time in my church. We had lots of black kids and stuff in the youth group, but some of that probably because I was one of the youth pastors. So that probably helped some. And we had black families and stuff that would come. But I was really, the mainstay there. I was the one. I was the one that they was chucking out. They were like, hey, put her on stage and this and that. But that's a whole other different conversation. But like, at first I was like, oh, this idea of you are wanting to reach out to black people, that's really great. But then the thing that got me, and this is the grinds my gears part of it, these people were racist as hell. Like the UPC was freaking racist. I did not know like the depths of how racist the UPC was until we left, until my church like left. And then I guess people just started, burying their souls because that's what white people do whenever they realize like, oh, hey, I used to do a racist. I did a racism. I won whatever. So I got to like, unburden myself and whatever. And so like, I didn't know because the church that I was at and the pastor that I had was like the church, let me rephrase this. There were people in the church who were racist. Absolutely. Absolutely. But there were some things because I didn't know about because people shielded me from, because I guess they wanted to have a black person at the church. And so they were like, ooh, we can't let her see the racism, so we're gonna like, we're gonna push these people aside and kind of shout at a curtain. And then some of the people didn't want to interact with me, so it was whatever. But that's a whole other different story. But I found out after we left that the culture of the UPC, things that I just hadn't seen, things that I had been shielded from, and circles and stuff, and the circles and stuff that my particular church ran in, we didn't see that. But like the whole foundation of the UPC is racist. Yet you were trying to attract people to this church, but y'all racist. And like some of these churches, like even like some people not believing in interracial mm-hmm. marriage, like thinking that interracial marriage was like a sin, or thinking that like black people were cursed because of the curse of Ham in Genesis 9, I think it was, thinking that applied to black people. And just like just a lot of other different things of just people's mindsets. Like people were just very, like there were people that were just racist. And like, and I saw that like in the wake of Ferguson, because you know, UPC is headquartered in St. Louis. And so I had a lot of friends who are St. Louisians and who were UPC, and you know, Ferguson's right. a suburb of St. Louis. So I got to see these people really perform and real, and like, oh wow, you think that about Black people? Oh my God. Like, that's horrible. But anyway, these people were horrifically racist, yet they had the temerity to try to evangelize Black people into their cult where they're just going to be racist. Like, I don't even know what the end game of that was. Like, how y'all going to be racist but then evangelize the people that you being racist toward? But anyway, all that to say, that grinds my gears.
Absolutely. And, you know, growing up in the United Pentecostal Church, I saw all kinds of wildly overtly racist things happen. I remember as a kid having, you know, they wouldn't have Halloween parties, but they would have harvest parties, and they would put on these skits. And this would have been the late 1970s, early 1980s, as recent as that. These kinds of things were happening. People performing in blackface.
Doing, oh my gosh.
And it goes beyond that. If you think about, at least in the United Pentecostal Church and in a lot of iterations of Pentecostal, white type churches, you have a traditional preaching style, that white preachers, engage in that is, very similar to the Black church, the call and response. And, you know, mm-hmm. I don't know if this is a term or not. Maybe I'm coining it, and maybe we can explore this further in a future episode. But to me, it smacks of homiletics is the study of and the delivery of preaching. So it's homiletics blackface is what it is. It's adopting those particular styles and then attempting to pass it off. And of course, everything that white people do that they appropriate from Black culture just comes off as mediocre and weird and awkward when they attempt to do it. And it's the same way, but they hold it up as the ideal, as the standard. And so that happens in the United Pentecostal Church. That happens in Baptist churches. I remember, at a previous institution where I taught that was owned and operated by the Southern Baptist Convention, they had a special speaker come in for chapel. And this was just a few years ago. And he was a white preacher, and he started talking about how he loves to preach to Black people, and that he's an honorary Black person. And it was problematic and racist as hell in so many ways. Afterwards, a lot of the Black students spoke up, and several of his faculty did as well. And there was an apology that was issued by the president, and the guy that preached even issued a so-called apology. He couched it in terms of, well, I didn't mean any harm. He gave out the token, I have lots of Black friends. So, yeah, and it happens a lot. And so I think that speaks to the larger context of what we've been talking about in this episode, that white supremacy and the white dominant culture that has been cultivated systemically in our nation and throughout the world for centuries continues to inform a lot of these cults. And again, cults can be on a spectrum where it's just weird, odd behavior, a high control behavior, to the other end of the spectrum where it can be deadly. So, I mean, I think there's so much that we could say about this. Unfortunately, we are running out of time. But Allie, I'll give you the last word as we conclude this episode.
Yeah. The only thing I got to say is that, cults definitely can be and are racist. And, if you have been in a cult or think that you might be in a cult, or adjacent to a cult, I encourage you to take a look around and see who's there and see who's part of it, who's been part of it, what kind of narratives and stuff that they have, and sound off. Let us know what you think about this episode. about your experiences with race and racism, or the things, racist things that you maybe have seen or experienced within the context of your high control group. And you can do that by emailing us. I bet you didn't know this, Scott, but we have an email, highcontrolpodcast@gmail.com. You can send, don't be sending us nothing. Don't be out here acting a fool, because that's just gonna be deleted or whatever. But if you have like genuine things that you want to share, topics that you think that you would want us to cover, whatever, feel free to email us. That is highcontrolpodcast@gmail.com. And don't forget to like our podcast, subscribe to it, rate it, review it on your podcast platform. That helps us to be able to get more visibility, so we can bring you more episodes. But I really hope that you've enjoyed this one.
Thank you so much, Allie, and thank all of you for listening to the High Control Podcast. And if this information benefits you or someone that you might know, please like, subscribe, and share this podcast. Until next time, I'm Scott Lloyd with my friend Allie Henney, and we'll see you again on the next episode of the High Control Podcast.
You've been listening to High Control. Don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe to our show. You can catch us on social media at High Control Pod. Check the show notes for resources and how to get in touch. Stay in control, friends.